Allison Levine is a mountaineer whose newly published book, On the Edge, is both a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. In it, she shares the lessons she has learned in some of the world's harshest environments. We're going to learn some of those lessons ourselves this morning, only we won't have to climb Mount Everest to get them. So I guess advantage us, perhaps. Allison Levine, welcome to the Joy Cardine program. I'm really happy to have you on this morning.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me on.
You served as the team captain of the first American women's Everest expedition, climbed the highest peak on every continent, skied to both the North and South Poles, a feat known as the Adventure Grand Slam. What is it that drives you?
Well, I just love being outdoors in these mountains, in these environments where you really learn to find that inner voice that tells you you can keep pushing through any amount of pain and discomfort. You can get out of your comfort zone. You can push past the limits that you thought you could go. And you learn so much about yourself along the way. But in addition to that, what I love is just the team dynamics aspects of it and the leadership aspects of it. And how do you take this team in this extreme remote environment, get them to all work together to achieve a common goal? And that's, you know, a lot of what I wrote about in my new book, which is called On the Edge, that just came out 2 weeks ago.
Well, okay, here comes a yes, but statement, so get ready. You've achieved all of this despite being born with a life-threatening heart condition and a circulatory disease that puts you at high risk of frostbite. What made you take on these extreme challenges, putting your health at risk in the process?
Well, I think, you know, everyone's going to have certain limitations that are placed on them for one reason or another, and there's always a workaround. And for me, with the heart defect that I was born with, I was born with a hole in my heart that got bigger as I got older. I had two surgeries by the time I turned 30 that cured that. So once that wasn't a problem anymore, that's sort of when I started getting involved in the sport of mountaineering. And with the circulatory issues that I have, I just use those chemical hand warmers that people use when they ski. They're, you know, a couple bucks, and you just, you know, you hold them in your gloves, and those tend to work for me pretty well, even at altitude.
So we'll step away from that now. That's history. But I needed to ask that right at the top. Bookstore shelves. Maybe I ought to go into radio. Bookstore shelves are stuffed with books on leadership. What makes yours different from the rest?
My book takes quite a contrarian view on leadership compared to the traditional books that are out there from various leadership and management gurus. And some of the things that I recommend in the book pretty much fly in the face of the other advice that's out there. And when you're in these remote, extreme environments, the rules change. For example, leaders don't have to spend a lot of time cheerleading and motivating because the environments themselves are inherently motivating. So people know if they don't move, they're going to die. But what is more challenging is that success in these types of environments is not defined by, you know, being the market leader, a certain amount of revenue, selling a certain amount of product. It's defined by whether or not your team comes back alive, or whether they come back hurt or healthy. So there's a lot more pressure. Emotions are very much heightened in these environments. And so the team dynamics become incredibly challenging. But for me, that's the stuff that's so fascinating to me. So there are a lot of rules that apply, you know, in everyday leadership scenarios that are completely different. In the mountains, for example, you know, you hear people talk about the importance of planning. You know, you got to have a good strategic plan. Well, when you're in these types of environments, whether it's a polar expedition or a high altitude expedition, you're in these environments that are constantly changing. So whatever plan you came up with, you know, last year, last month, even that morning, these plans are outdated as soon as they're finished when you're in environments that change very rapidly. So you cannot be hell-bent on sticking to your plan. And, you know, the other thing that's very different about these environments is that the leaders tend to do more work, you know, and you know, more, much more is required of them than what is required of the people on the team. So the leaders are the first ones up in the morning. They're carrying, you know, the heaviest backpacks. They're making, you know, they're making the dinners at night. They're cooking all the meals. They're the last ones to eat. They're the, you know, first ones up. And they're right out there, you know, on the front lines with their teams. There's really no separation of duties between the leaders and the people on the team. The leaders are having to deal with this, all the same hardships that the people on the team have to deal with, if not more.
Leading from in front.
Exactly. And it's the, you know, it's interesting because the military has the philosophy of leaders eat last, right? So enlisted soldiers eat first, followed by non-commissioned officers, followed by commissioned officers, followed by the commanding officers. And the commanding officers do not get a bit of food until all their people are taken care of. And that's how it works in these extreme environments in the mountains and on polar expeditions, too. You do not take care of yourself until your entire team has been taken care of. And that's not necessarily the way we work in the business world, or, you know, especially in politics, doesn't work that way either.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, most of us are, and I'll just say, I'm never going to ski to either pole, or even across the street for that matter. Certainly not going to attempt Mount Everest. What are the parallels between what you've experienced in this extreme world? Okay, so how do we bring this into the world of the chief executive and the middle manager? Who's going to benefit the most from what you've written here? And how is it that, how do we take these lessons that you've learned on Mount Everest and other places that you've been and apply them in the workday world?
The book really applies to people at all levels. And the overarching theme of On the Edge is that everybody is in a leadership position, and leadership has nothing to do with title or tenure or where you work or how many people report to you or how large of a budget you oversee. It's really about realizing that we're all responsible for looking out for the people around us and for helping them move forward with the mission as well. And, for example, let's say you're in the middle of Antarctica and something happens to the designated team leader. The rest of the team needs to be able to step up to the plate and move forward with the mission, because in Antarctica, it could be days, weeks, maybe even months before a rescue is going to happen. So you can't just, you know, throw up your arms and say, well, you know, now we're really screwed. What are we going to do? You know, so that's why it's so important for everybody on the team to empower themselves to think and act like a leader so they can survive when that leader's not there. And if you read the book Into Thin Air, John Krakauer's best-selling book about the 1996 Everest disaster, which was the deadliest season in the history of climbing Everest, you know, a lot of things went wrong that season, and I think it's really hard to judge unless you were actually there. But one thing's for sure, and that's that two of the world's most experienced, most talented, high-altitude mountain guides died on Everest that season. And once those guides weren't around, their teams had no idea what to do. People got caught overnight in a storm. People were lost. Lives were lost. And that's a perfect example of a team that did not empower themselves to think and act like leaders. If the designated leader wasn't there, nobody knew what to do. So everyone within an organization, whether your organization is, you know, the business world or, you know, involvement in your community or on a sports team, everybody has to realize that leadership is their responsibility. They are responsible for helping the team move forward with the mission, and they are absolutely responsible for looking out for the people around them.
Where do you come down on the debate between whether leadership is a trait that people are born with or a skill that they can learn?
That's a great debate, and I think there's a little bit of both. There are certain personal traits that you're born with that do help with leadership, being communicative, being outgoing. You know, and that's not to say, look, there's plenty of introverts that are fabulous leaders, but there are certain things that work to your advantage when it comes to leadership. But I think leadership can absolutely be learned by everyone. And I think it's something that should be learned by everyone. And I always say it's sort of like, you know, my book, when I wrote On the Edge, I wanted it to be like P90X, but instead of for your abs, it's for your leadership muscles. It's something that you should practice every day, something you should think about every day, something you should put effort to, you know, effort into every day. And becoming a good leader doesn't just happen by itself. You have to work at it, just like you got to work at six-pack abs, got to work your leadership muscles as well. And so it's, you know, it's not something that happens, but I do believe everybody has the ability to be a good leader, but it's not just something they're born with.
We're talking with Allison Levine, mountaineer and leadership expert. She is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership. Wondering what questions you might have for our guest today. Have you braved some extreme conditions and lived to tell the tale? What leadership lessons or useful life lessons did you learn from those experiences? Do you think leadership is forged by living through tough life experiences? And perhaps you could share some useful lessons you may have learned by going through some challenging physical situation. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. You can also reach us via email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can go to the Joy Cardine Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. Allison Levine, you mentioned that some of the advice that you have for people in this book may seem a little bit counterintuitive. I'd like to talk about that for just a moment. Well, actually, we'll come back to some of this probably again and again, but a few things that are from your book, examples. Look for teammates with big egos. When you're making progress, turn around and change direction. Practice sleep deprivation. Don't try to overcome weakness, and success can be a problem. I mean, I have to say, when I read those, having studied a lot of leadership stuff over the years, I looked at that and I said, I'm going to be very interested to find out what she means by this. And I think our listeners probably have the same reaction when they hear me say something like success can be a problem. For most of us, success is what we're working for all the time. And we think it's, you know, what was it? Vince Lombardi said, winning isn't everything. It's the most important thing. And if it wasn't, why would we keep score, or why wouldn't we keep score? So success can be a problem. What do you mean by that?
Well, I had this, one of the most interesting conversations I had about this was with a guy named Pete Dawkins. Pete Dawkins is a retired general in the Army. He went to West Point. He was first in his class at West Point. He was a Heisman Trophy winner, a Rhodes Scholar, and as I mentioned, rose to the ranks of general in the Army. Back when Pete Dawkins was a captain, he wrote an article for Infantry Magazine called The Freedom to Fail. And I had the most interesting conversation with him about this, because he points out that in general, not just the Army, but you know, most business environments as well, we tend to look at people with these perfect track records and think, this is a successful person. This is the person who's going to be able to contribute the most to our team. These are the people we should value the most. But oftentimes, it's the people with these perfect track records that have never really pushed themselves beyond, you know, their limits and stretched outside their comfort zones and taken on big risks. And often it's the people who have stumbled and have been bruised and bloodied a little bit who are out there really pushing the limits, really taking the risks, and paving the way for other people. For example, everyone knows the name Sir Edmund Hillary and also the name Tenzing Norgay, the first guys to summit Mount Everest, right? That's a huge deal. But there were dozens of climbers who attempted Everest before those two. And, of course, no one knows their names. No one knows any names, you know, prior to Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary, other than, you know, George Mallory and Sandy Irvine, who disappeared on the mountain 10 years prior to Hillary, and there was a movie made about them and some books. So some people know their names. But, look, there were dozens of climbers that attempted Everest before Hillary. No one knows who they are. But you don't, I mean, you got to believe that Hillary and Norgay absolutely benefited from the 411 that they got from all these previous expeditions. And it was only because all these other people tried and failed that they were able to succeed. So we need to be much more failure tolerant, because a lack of failure tolerance really stifles progress and innovation and prevents people from taking risks.
Sort of like the old adage, I never learned anything by doing it right the first time.
Exactly. So that's, you know, that's one of them. One of the other things you mentioned was about look for teammates with big egos. And this was some interesting advice I got from Coach K. So if you're not familiar with Coach K, it's Coach Mike Krzyzewski. He's the head coach at Duke University, the head men's basketball coach. He's the winningest coach in the history of men's Division I college basketball. He's also, if you're not a college basketball fan, the head coach of the U.S. men's Olympic team. Now, when he puts together his national, you know, the men's national basketball team, he has the entire pool of the NBA to pull from, right? That's a pretty big talent pool. So in a conversation with him, I learned what he looks for when he's recruiting his team for the Olympic team. I thought, how do you narrow that down? There's so many great players. And he explained, I look for ego. And I thought, right, because you don't want ego. That's bad. You know, leave your ego at the door. And he said, no, you want ego. And he explained that there's two kinds of ego that he looks for. The first is what he calls performance ego. And he said, I want people who are good and who know that they're good. He said, I don't want LeBron James to come out onto the court and not be LeBron James. And he said, I hate that expression, leave your ego at the door. And that made sense to me, right? You want people who are good and who know that they're good. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be high up on Mount Everest about to ascend the Hillary Step, which is a 40-foot pitch of nearly vertical rock and ice. I don't want to be stuck up there behind some climber who's not moving, thinking, gosh, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be here, maybe I'm out of my league. You want people who are up there thinking, yeah, I got this. No problem. I got this. And then the second type of ego he looks for is what he calls team ego. And he said it's important to recruit people who are going to be proud to be part of something that collectively is more important than any of the individuals. And that made sense to me as well. I thought, yeah, you know what? You want people with big egos.
We're going to take a break, and then we come back. When we come back, we'll talk some more with Allison Levine about her book, On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership. Hopefully you'll want to join us as well at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or leave a comment or question on the Joy Cardine Facebook page. Talking with Allison Levine, mountaineer and leadership expert this morning on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership is the book we're talking about this hour with Allison Levine, mountaineer and leadership expert. She's been to Mount Everest twice, been to both the North and South Poles. A pretty amazing life. Also an MBA. Is there no end to Allison Levine's accomplishments? I have to wonder. Most of us would kill to have a resume like this. Before we get back into discussing your book, Allison Levine, you wrote a short piece in Time magazine recently where you basically asked us to embrace the polar vortex and said that the cold makes us smarter. I have to say, as someone who's lived in northern Wisconsin for most of my life, I found that amusing in an ironic sort of way. Let's put the best face on this. Yes, it's cold, but by golly, I feel a lot smarter now.
Well, I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, so that explains a lot.
So, briefly, how does the cold make us smarter?
Well, it actually takes more energy, more glucose, to cool off the human body when it's hot than it does to warm up the body when it's cold. And that glucose is the same energy that feeds the brain. So you figure if your body is using more energy to cool off when it's hot, that's less available glucose for the brain, and therefore your brain doesn't have as much, you know, available glucose and isn't going to function quite as well. So the logic is, so if you're cold, then the energy you have to use to warm up is less than the amount of energy you use to cool off, therefore more glucose available to the brain, therefore you're smarter, therefore you should run out and take a Mensa exam when it's really, really cold out.
I'll make a note of that. Actually, that reminded me of something my father once told me. He said, son, when it's cold, you can always put on another layer, but when it's hot, there's only so much they'll let you take off.
Exactly. Without getting arrested.
Well, yeah. And actually, you reach it. There's actually a solid limit there to how much can come off, but we won't go into that. I don't need people to think about that visual today. Let's talk about it. You have a different definition of the idea of being prepared than most people do. What do you mean when you use be prepared? What do you mean as opposed to what, say, the Boy Scouts mean?
Well, there's a couple of things that go into being prepared. First is having all the necessary tools you need to get the job done. And it's an interesting balance when you're on a mountaineering expedition because everything you have, you got to carry in your backpack. So you don't necessarily want to have a lot of extra stuff because it's going to slow you down. You need to save weight. You only need to take, you know, you can really only take the essentials, what you need to survive. So you have that stuff in your backpack. But the problem is, you know, it's a catch-22 because if you don't have something you need, your entire expedition could be at risk. You could put yourself in danger because you didn't have a spare bulb for your headlamp so you can't see at night. You can put yourself in danger because you didn't have a protective sleeve on your water bottle and your water bottle froze and now you can't drink anything, so you're going to be dehydrated. And that's a huge risk. If you don't have the proper warm clothes, warm extra layers, warm gloves, if you lose a glove, you know, you're taking off or putting on a glove and the wind picks it up and it's gone, you could lose fingers to frostbite. So little things like that can put you at risk. If you need a spare pair of gloves, you need a spare headlamp bulb, a spare headlamp battery, things like that. So it's you're constantly trying to weigh, you know, what do I take with me? What do I absolutely need? And what's going to weigh me down and cause me to go slower? So that's the part of preparation that has to do with the physical things you take with you. The other part is obviously showing up physically prepared. And I have an interesting way of training to prepare for a big expedition. It's not unusual on these mountains to have to climb through the entire night. Sometimes you have to climb for 14, 18, 20 or more hours. You climb through the night with no sleep. You're often dehydrated, low on calories, and I find that especially the sleep deprivation really stresses people out. And sleep deprivation tends to stress people out on an everyday basis, too. When you're in the office and you've got to, you know, you're going to work really late or you're going to be up through the entire night and you start thinking, oh, my gosh, how am I going to function? I'm only going to get 2 hours of sleep or 4 hours of sleep or I'm not going to be able to get any sleep. And there's all this anxiety and stress associated with that. So I actually have my own system of preparing for that where I train in sleep-deprived conditions. And I will go to Mount Shasta, which is a little over 14,000 feet. It's just south of the Oregon border. It's about a six-hour drive from my house in San Francisco. I start from the parking lot at 11 o'clock at night. I put on a heavy pack, and I climb for 14 or 16 hours to the top of the mountain and back down in one push without sleep. I try to do it without food and water, although I keep those things in my backpack in case of emergency, because I want to throw my body into that state of deprivation so I know what it feels like. And I know that I can keep pushing when I feel completely exhausted and hungry and dehydrated. And my philosophy is that if you practice sleep deprivation, then you know you can function when you have to. And then you're not stressed out about it. So you can either be sleep deprived and super stressed about it, or you can just be sleep deprived. And I think it's better to just be sleep deprived. Now, is it, you know, be sleep deprived without the stress that goes along with it? Is it good for you to go without sleep and to deprive yourself of food and water? No, it's not good for you. It's terrible for you. But, I mean, I didn't write a book about how to live to be 100. I wrote a book about how to get through the most difficult of situations when you absolutely have to. And I think practicing being in that state of deprivation is helpful. And then when you have to do it, it's no big deal. You're like, yeah, no sleep. I can keep working. I've done this. I can push right on through. It's not a problem.
I just made a note. I'm hoping my boss wasn't listening to this hour. But what do okay, that's fine. You've got a mountain to climb. There's a situation where you don't really have any choice. Take this idea of the sleep deprivation and apply it to corporate America or any organization where you've got some leadership issues. People need to lead. What is it about practice sleep deprivation that applies to the non-mountain climber?
So everyone on a team needs to be a clutch player. You need to be the person that people can count on to come through no matter what. And when you commit to delivering something, whether it's some kind of report or a marketing plan or whatever it is that you told your team and your colleagues that you were going to deliver, that you were going to have ready tomorrow morning by 8 a.m., you better damn well work through the night to have it ready by tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. And none of this, oh, well, I worked till 10 and then I had to go home and so I didn't get it done, or I had to go do this, or this other thing distracted me so it's not finished. No, you deliver what you said you're going to deliver in the manner in which you promised it and by the time you said you would have it to whoever it is that you're delivering to. You be that clutch player. You be the person who comes through. And sometimes that's going to require working through the entire night and not sleeping at all, or maybe only sleeping for 2 hours. I mean, it's just about being the person who always comes through for your team. And sometimes you're going to have to sacrifice sleep in order to be that person.
That reminds me of a plaque that my daughter once gave me for Christmas, and it's still in my office on my wall. It says, "If it weren't for the last minute, nothing would get done."
I love that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like the famous saying, time is what keeps everything from happening at once. Let's go to the phones and take a call from Rachel in Mequon. Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Go ahead.
Hi, Allison.
Hi,
I'm also, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. I'm also from Arizona, and I live in Mequon, Wisconsin. And I think it's funny because people always are, especially now, are talking about the polar vortex and the extreme weather. And you have actually lived in a tent in those climates. What do you say to people now that are trying to deal with our 35 below and our extreme weather when that's just probably not that extreme for you anymore? And I know you have to condition it, but what would you say to our friends in Wisconsin about dealing with the weather? Because you would literally sleep in a tent and not sleep and have to hike up a mountain.
Right. And the difference is when you're on a mountaineering expedition, whether you're high up on a mountain or even heading to the North Pole or the South Pole, there's no escape really from the cold weather. You realize that you're in this weather, it's going to be uncomfortable, but this is the way it is. But the good part is that it's only temporary. The expeditions that I go on, the longer ones are 2 months. So yes, it's difficult to think, oh my gosh, I'm freezing my ass off. But you know what? It's only 2 months, I can make it. As cold as it gets in any of these cities across the country, you realize you have an escape route. You can go inside and get away from it. When you're on these mountains, there's no ski lodge you can go to go in and have a cup of hot cocoa or something like that. I mean, you know you're out there in the elements, but it's temporary. So pain, any amount of pain and discomfort, you just know you have to suck it up for a certain amount of time, and then at some point it's going to get better. But, you know, again, the nice thing is when you live in a city or you're, you know, down at sea level, heck, go into the lodge, get a cup of hot cocoa, go back into your house, go sit in your car and turn the heater on. Just remember, when you're outside and you're freezing and you feel like you're miserable, it's only temporary.
Well, in my case, in about a week and a half, I'm going to be playing golf in Mesa, so I'll be escaping the polar vortex at least for a few days.
And Rachel's my Delta Gamma sister, by
the way. Ah, okay. There's the connection. Got it.
Sorority sister.
Okay. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for the call. You could be next at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is our email address. You can also leave a comment or question on the Joy Cardine Program Facebook page. Let's take a break. And when we come back, there's a couple of other pieces of rather contrarian advice that you give us in your book. I think my favorite is don't try to overcome weakness. I want to talk about that first, and then we've got a lot of other stuff and nowhere near enough time to get through all of it. My guest is Alison Levine, mountaineer and leadership expert. She's the author of On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership. We'll have more of our conversation with Alison and with you at 800-642-1234 in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The book is On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership. Alison Levine is its author. She's a mountaineer and leadership expert. She's been there and done that. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. We'll get to some calls in just a moment. One of the things you tell us in your book is don't try to overcome weakness. That requires an explanation.
Yes, it definitely requires an explanation.
So give it to us.
There's so much pressure all the time. You hear, you got to overcome your weakness. You can, if you work really hard, you can overcome your weakness. Well, I actually think that's crap, because a lot of times you can't overcome your weakness. For example, I am pretty small and I'm short. I'm 5'4", weigh about 110 pounds. When on an expedition, I have to carry the same amount of weight as somebody who's 6'4" and 230 pounds. So on our Antarctic ski traverse, where we covered 600 miles of Antarctic ice on skis from the edge of the Western Antarctic ice shelf all the way to the South Pole, you have to drag a 150-pound sled full of your gear and supplies that's harnessed to your waist. Well, no matter how hard I train, no matter how strong I am, the law of physics basically dictates that somebody who is 6'4", 230 pounds, is going to be able to haul a 150-pound sled much more quickly and much more efficiently than somebody who is my size. And, look, I trained my butt off before we went on this trip, and I thought, I'm going to show up. I'm going to be the most prepared person there. There is, I'll be a great contributor to my team. I want to be the person that everybody on the team thinks, oh, I'm so glad she's part of our team, right? That's my goal on every trip. I really want my teammates to feel like I'm that person. So part of that, show up prepared, show up ready for action. So we get to Antarctica, start the ski expedition, and I can't keep up with my larger teammates. I'm struggling every day for hours. You're out on the ice, you're skiing for 12 or 15 hours a day. I could not keep up. My teammates were always a few minutes ahead of me. Now you might think, so what? A few minutes ahead of you, what's the big deal? Well, in normal environments, it's not a big deal, but in Antarctica, it is a big deal, because when people have to stop and wait for you, they're going to become hypothermic and they're risking frostbite. So it is a big deal, because the only way you can stay warm when you're outside your tent is to move, is to be moving, to be skiing. So my teammates were constantly having to wait for me, and no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't keep up with them. And I was really, really frustrated. It really affected me psychologically, because I was thinking, I bet these people wish I weren't part of their team because I'm slowing them down. I'm the weak link. And it felt terrible to be the weak link. And I'd always been one of the stronger people on previous expeditions in the mountains. But on this polar jaunt, I was absolutely the weakest person. And there was nothing I could do to overcome the fact that I was too small to haul that sled as quickly as the larger people. But the team leader handled the situation so brilliantly, and I overheard him talking in his tent about four or five nights into the trip. I overheard Eric talking to my teammate George. So Eric was the team leader. He's from Australia, and he said to George, I feel so bad for Allison. She's really trying hard, but she's not able to keep up. And George said, I know. She's so much smaller than everybody else, and she's got that heavy sled, and I feel bad for her, too. She's really, putting in a huge effort. You know, we should try to help her out. And I overheard my two teammates not talking about what a burden it was to have me on the team, but talking about how much they appreciated my effort and how much they wanted to help me. And the next day, what they did was absolutely brilliant. Eric got out of the tent, and he said to everyone on the team, hey, you guys, before we hit the ice today, I just want to weigh everyone's sleds. I want to make sure that they all weigh about the same amount. George, do me a favor. Grab the end of your sled. Let's pick this sled up and weigh it. So they each grabbed an end of George's sled. They lifted it up off the ice, put it back down. All right, this sled feels okay. Grab the end of my sled there, buddy. And they picked up Eric's sled, weighed it. Yeah, this feels okay. You know, they put it back down. Grab the end of Moretta's sled, and they grabbed another sled, and they picked it up, weighed it. And then Eric said to George, hey, grab the end of Allison's sled. Let's weigh that one. And they each grab an end of my sled and simultaneously pick it up only about 6 inches off the ground, drop it back down, start clutching their backs like they just tried to lift an elephant. And Eric said, oh, my gosh, what is in this sled? This is crazy. You have the heaviest sled of any person on this team. Why are you carrying so much more weight than everybody? And George said, yeah, this is crazy. This sled, way too heavy. We got to even things out here a little bit. And they started taking weight out of my sled and putting it in their own sled, meaning they were lightening my load and making their own sleds heavier. So now they had to work harder because I wasn't able to keep up with the team. But the way they handled it was so brilliant because they made me feel like I was a valuable contributor and that they wanted me to succeed. And they could have said, hey, listen, you're slow. You're slowing us down. We're getting cold waiting for you. We're going to take weight out of your sled, and we'll carry more to allow you to keep up with the team. And then I would have felt even worse because, trust me, I was very aware of the fact that I was the slowest, weakest person on the team. But the way Eric handled it really made me feel even more loyal to him and made me want to contribute even more. And so what I did is I immediately started thinking, wow, how am I going to return this favor? Well, what I noticed was that every night after you ski for 15 hours, you set up camp and you have to build a snow barricade around your tent. It's this big wall of ice and snow that you build to protect your tent from the elements. And what I noticed was that these taller guys had trouble using the short snow shovel because you bring a very small, light shovel. And someone who's 6'4", who's trying to bend over to use this short shovel, these guys were really tweaking their backs trying to shovel snow. Well, of course, at 5'4", I'm much lower to the ground. And I can use a short shovel without screwing up my back. So I said to those guys, hey, you know, let me shovel the snow around your tent. I'll build the tent barricade. And they said, you want to do what? And I said, I want to shovel the snow and build your snow barricade around your tent. And they said, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, because I love to shovel snow. And they said, why, what? You know, they looked at me like I was from another planet. And I said, yes, I grew up in Phoenix, and we never got to shovel snow there. And so shoveling snow is a treat for me, and I love to do it, and never got to do it as a kid. So I grabbed the snow shovel, and I would, at night, shovel the snow around their tent to help them out. And it was a way that my size actually played to my advantage, being shorter and lower to the ground. And I found a way that I could contribute more, you know, that played to my strength. And it's just a reminder that sometimes people are not going to be able to overcome a weakness. I was never going to be able to overcome the fact that I was shorter and smaller than the rest of the team. But I found a way to compensate for that weakness. And in the book, On the Edge, I talk about how it is a leader's responsibility to help people compensate for their weaknesses, to get creative and help people find their sweet spot so they'll be a valuable member of the team, rather than hammering people to overcome a weakness. that they may never be able to overcome.
Let's take a phone call here. Jeff in Madison is with us today. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Yes, this is fascinating for me. I do leadership training with teams from the United Nations and other disaster response agencies like CARE International, et cetera, who go into some very difficult conditions, places hit by typhoons or conflict or whatever. And a lot of what you're talking about sounds very much like the leadership needs in those cases, team leadership or leadership from all members of the team. They obviously go into, they're not in these cold areas, they're probably burning more glucose, I guess, as you've said. But I'm wondering, the foundation of a lot of this training that I'm asked to do has to do with skills of emotional intelligence and leadership styles. Emotional intelligence being skills of recognizing one's own emotional content or conditions at the time, recognizing those of the team, social awareness and empathy, et cetera. And I'm just wondering whether these concepts are in your book, whether you deal with these as a leadership, I won't say consultant, but advisor, if you will, and how those play out in your thinking. And I'll listen to you.
That's a great question. And it's interesting because the environments that you're talking about have a lot of similarities, as you said, in that people need to be able to think and act quickly. The rules, you know, there are no hard and fast rules. You've got to be able to take action based on what's going on at the time, you know, rather than, you know, based on whatever plan that you'd set up, because things change so quickly. But I have an interesting chapter about Coach Phil Jackson and how he handled Dennis Rodman. So Dennis Rodman was known as, you know, a problem player in the NBA, had kinds of crazy behavioral problems, and I mean, with North Korea stuff aside, this is, you know, before that, and Phil Jackson actually took the time to get to know Dennis Rodman on a personal level. Instead of looking at him as just a player on his team, look, you're part of the team, he got to know him as an individual, and he figured out what made Dennis Rodman tick, and he figured out why Dennis Rodman behaved the way he behaved a lot of the time, and through taking the time to get to know him, he was able to adjust the way he adjust his expectations of Rodman and adjust the way he treated Rodman. And leaders need to treat everyone fairly, but they don't necessarily need to treat everyone equally. You don't have to treat everyone the same, but you have to treat everyone fairly. And Phil Jackson found a way to work around some of Dennis Rodman's issues and problems and ended up really getting so much out of Rodman, who is, you know, one of the best players and best defensive players in the history of the NBA, was inducted into the Hall of Fame, but other coaches saw him as a problem and didn't want to deal with him. Jackson figured out how to get into his head and was able to really turn him into an incredibly valuable player.
Thanks so much for that call. One thing, you confess that you're introverted to the point of hiding in bathrooms to avoid talking to people. Yet your book is all about helping people overcome their fears. How did your expeditions help you overcome your social fears?
I do have issues with it. It's interesting because I work quite a bit as a keynote speaker, and I'm fine when I'm up on stage, and I probably seem like the most outgoing person, and I'm, you know, telling jokes and, you know, lots of energy. But when I have to go to a client cocktail party prior to a presentation, that to me creates so much anxiety. Oh my gosh! I mean, it's stressful for me for whatever reason to have to go in and socialize with people that I don't know, and so that part's difficult. But that's different because when you're in these extreme environments, you absolutely have to branch out and network, because that could save your life in one of these extreme environments. So that's what helps me get over that in you know, the mountains or on a polar expedition, because you can't just have a good working relationship with the people on your team. You have to be very strategic and think about who outside of your team you might need to call on for help at some point. And you have to have these relationships in place before you need the help. So the first thing I do when I get to base camp on any mountain, very first thing, I walk around, I talk to every other team that's there. And people tease me all the time, oh, Allison, you're so social. And it's not about being social, okay? It's about the fact that, God forbid, something should happen to someone on one of my teams, high up on one of these peaks. I need the people around us to feel obligated to help us. And the only way that's going to happen is if you have relationships in place with lots of other people outside of your team. And I feel like almost every year there's a story about some climber high up on Mount Everest that's struggling to survive. And you hear these stories about other teams that will march right past this person because nobody wants to give up their summit bid to stop and help save a life. And it's tragic that that happens. It should never happen. But unfortunately, the reality is that it does happen. But if you have strong relationships in place with other people outside of your team, those people will stop and help you out when you need the help. But it's up to you to be proactive about forming those partnerships. And that's why getting out of your comfort zone, doing the networking, connecting with other people is really important in these environments, and it could actually save your life.
Well, just like being at 28,000 feet above sea level, the clock is ticking here as well. And there's one thing I wanted to get to before we ran out of time, but not oxygen. I just want to read a paragraph from your book. A great fallacy regarding progress is that it is defined by constant forward motion in the same direction. We assume that any steps in the opposite direction take us farther from our goal. But you don't agree with that, and I think this is where we're going to end up closing the program.
I don't agree with that. And on a big mountain, because you have to take the time to get used to the altitude, because your body deteriorates. Once you're above about 18,000 feet, your body starts to deteriorate and your muscles are getting weaker. But you want to spend time up high above 18,000 feet so you can get used to the altitude, because your body will produce more blood cells as you get higher on the mountain. It produces more blood cells to carry oxygen throughout your body. So you want to produce those blood cells, but it's also harder on your muscles. So what you do when you're climbing a big peak like this is you climb up high on the mountain, you spend some time up high, and then you retreat back to base camp. You spend a few days and nights at base camp. The next day you climb up higher. You climb even higher than you were the day before, and you spend time up at a higher camp than that. And then you retreat back down to base camp. So throughout the two-month expedition period, you're climbing up high, and then you're coming back down to base camp throughout the expedition. And you have to continue doing that acclimatization process before you can go for the summit. And it's very physically challenging, obviously, to be climbing up high and then back down low. But psychologically, it's incredibly frustrating as well. But what you have to remember is that even though you are going backwards, you're still making progress because you're helping your body acclimatize and adjust to the altitude. So for whatever reason, you know, we think progress has to occur in one direction, but sometimes you do have to go backwards in order to eventually get to where you want to be.
Well, we've reached the summit of this program and have nowhere to go but down from here. Allison Levine, thank you for an extremely entertaining hour.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And if you want to know more, you can go out and buy the book On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership. It's in all bookstores now.
All right. Thanks so much. Allison Levine, mountaineer and leadership expert, the author of the New York Times bestseller On the Edge, The Art of High Impact Leadership. Marika Suval produced this hour of programming. Bill Martins handled directing chores, and Cynthia Schuster handled on-air production. I'm John Munson. In for Joy Cardine, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.